Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Daryl Pinkney. He's the author of a new novel called Black Deutschland. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I've wanted to meet Daryl Pinkney for a very long time. He is a brilliant critic. He appears frequently in the pages of the New York Review of Books. I read a book of his some years ago called Out There, Mavericks of Black Literature, and I learned a lot that I hadn't even begun to know, because you were writing about people who people don't know. And I think that in a lot of your work, the first novel, High Cotton, the new novel, Black Deutschland, you're introducing your readers to realms in which they're likely to be unfamiliar. You're taking them on an expatriate experience. What's attractive to you about the expatriate world?
I think that it comes from my own introduction to African-American literature. Richard Wright was very important to my father, and then James Baldwin became very important to me, and their living abroad was very important to them. Kind of as a solution to how to be a black man in America, meaning don't be here that often, but also what are the experiences writers need or can look for. I think also when I was growing up, Europe and European ideas represented something very definite insofar as personal liberation, things like that. So Europe called out in that way.
And where did you live?
In Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I left New York and went to Berlin for a number of years. And there I met my partner, and he's British. And so I moved to Oxford for an even longer time. And now we live in Harlem.
You went to school at Columbia, yes?
Yes.
Who did you study with? Who were the teachers at Mount?
When I was a student in the early 1970s, New York was considered a very dangerous place, and Johnny Carson would make jokes about it. So the admissions office was very frank about the kind of students they would try to get, who maybe weren't perfect, but had something to recommend them or some outstanding passion. So one of my classmates was, for instance, Luke Sont and Jim Jarmusch were very good friends, and it was the kind of place where your peers were a source of education. Luke Sont introduced me to Rimbaud. I'm from Indiana. I'd never heard of Rimbaud. But probably the most important class for me was Elizabeth Hardwick's writing class, and that changed my life.
Lizzie Hardwick was a magnificent essayist, at one time the wife of Robert Lowell, and she perfected a kind of writing in a book called Sleepless Nights that's half fantasia, half diary, all improvisation. And it's extraordinary. And I'd say that a book like that underlies your new novel, Black Deutschland. Would you agree?
Yes. In the sense that her work probably is in most everything I do, just as she remains an ideal reader for me. I write for her, though she's no longer here. I write for my, well, it's not true. I was about to say I write for my parents, but actually Black Deutschland exists because they're not here. So a kind of candor about sexual matters I have now that when they were alive I didn't. Not because they disapproved or anything like that. It's my own self-consciousness and lack of courage and the fact that they read everything. They subscribed to the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker, the Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, etc. I was busted once for smoking pot on the street and I wrote something about it for the New Yorker. I had to call my father up and tell him before his issue arrived. And I was in my late 40s then.
That's great.
And he chewed me out for half an hour, just really raked me over the coals. You can get arrested for civil disobedience, but not for smoking pot. So, you know, they had a judgment about everything I wrote, so.
Darryl Pinckney, my guest, the author of Black Deutschland, was also a friend of Susan Sontag, who was an enormous influence on me as well. She makes two appearances in this book, but in particular she appears in the final paragraph. She's given pride of place, in a sense, as the book says goodbye and packs up what's going to be permanent, the boxes of books. Mm. And I wondered if you'd read that last paragraph, simply because this is a book where it's a good idea to begin at the end and make your way through it as you find your way.
Okay.
This is Darryl Pinckney reading the last paragraph of Black Deutschland.
I knew that one day I would get too old to move those boxes of books, but I could not give them up. They held my undying love. I looked back and saw myself standing in the rain with the suitcase. The Salat al-Maghreb drifted from an innermost courtyard. Rise up with your bad self one last time, O splendid Susan Sontag. She told me home is the place where there is someone who does not wish you any pain.
Darryl Pinckney reading the last paragraph of his novel. Now, I want to unpack that with you because in, I believe, the first sentence of the book, we're told it doesn't always start with a suitcase, but the book does end with a suitcase.
Yes.
And first of all, what is the Salat al-Maghreb?
It's a call to prayer in sort of Islam. So certain neighborhoods in Berlin at the time, you could hear, you know, this kind of a music, as it were, drifting over the street from some place you couldn't see.
And this Berlin, a combination of West and East Berlin, because it's before the wall comes down.
Yeah.
And in this book, all the things that you, well, thought you'd find drifting across this landscape are there. There's a great moment of solidarity as people across the wall coming down say, do you like Fassbinder? And someone else says, yeah.
Or when the East Berliners come to this bar in West Berlin and guys just stand there saying, do you like Blackbeard? Do you like Fassbinder? Just leading them in cheers that make no sense. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The joining of cultures. But what we've been seeing all through this book are too many cultures to make much sense of. The hero, Jed, has a boyfriend. He's wanted a pink and yellow boyfriend, but he gets a black French boyfriend, very beautiful, a soccer player. But there are so many enjambments of culture here that for us to hear a Muslim prayer just before the ghost of Susan Sontag rises is spectacular.
Oh, well, you're very kind. It is an honor to be here and to talk to you. And you are the guy who could tell Susan Sontag what to read and she would read it and like it. I never had that nerve. But
on occasion. But let's again unpack that. Rise up with your bad self one last time. Tell us.
Well, that is calling to our absent friend.
Yes.
I put her in at the end because she did actually say that, and I didn't want to rob her of the line. So that's why I have the narrator come across her in a bookstore sometime before, just to set up the last line. And it is, she was a very famous presence in Berlin, but she would stress that she wasn't one of the adults in my life. She wanted to be more like a big sister, and she was terribly good fun because she had a curiosity and an appetite for just about everything in the arts. And for someone whose image has a lot to do with arrogance and unfriendly, actually she was very humble about the arts and the things she cared about. When you look back at her work, most of what she wrote were appreciations, and they're very hard to do. But she really wanted to share her enthusiasms with people, and especially with friends. And she would take you to a dozen things a day if you had the energy.
Yeah. Susan Sontag would work all night long on a simple blurb, a three-sentence blurb. Yeah. She wanted to say exactly what she meant. And she's something of a presiding deity here in this book, because in a sense, the hero, Jed, is good at nothing. Susan wouldn't have been interested in Jed.
No.
But if she had taken him under her wing, he'd have emerged a different person. She was one of the few people who could work metamorphosis on people.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jed needs metamorphosis. Now, why, tell me, why did you choose, you know, it's been, what, 22 years since your last novel. Why did you choose to write a novel about a hopeless case?
I think I used the first person in both books because of what you said at the beginning. It's an unfamiliar story, or one where the person needs a certain authority to tell it, meaning this is his experience or his relation to the world or these questions he wants to ask of the world. High Cotton was about, say, my grandparents' generation, and the shadow they cast over the life of this young narrator who wanted to avoid certain categories of black experience without even knowing particularly why. In Black Deutschland, we have someone I think of more as descended from the rootless Russian clerks in 19th century Russian literature of Gogol or Dostoevsky, who's sort of floating on the city. He's got no real purpose. But Berlin in the time of the wall was full of people like Jed. It's the perfect sort of town for someone lost in his own dreams, because there is, you know, the past still sitting there, and then the future is not clear. When I lived there, no one thought the wall would go down, except for Susan, by the way. And she was one day so busy talking about it, she actually ran into the wall. We were in Kreuzberg walking along, and she was going on and on about something, and she went right in. I promise you, she hit the wall. It was really funny.
I'm talking to Daryl Pinkney. He's the author of Black Deutschland. We're following a character named Jed
Goodfinch.
In Germany. He's left college. He's left behind the possibilities that most people took for equal opportunity. He's very bright. He's interested in architecture. He makes friends among those who know fairly easily, and yet he hasn't given himself the opportunity to really grow into the positions that are open to him. He sort of is like one of those people who aspire to being a know-it-all, you know, one of those brilliant hippies we used to see who could hold forth on anything but also could settle down to nothing.
I don't know if he is meant to have enough ego to hold forth. He holds forth to himself in his privacy. He can't get out of himself to really to connect with others. I think also the time period is important, because in the 80s when he leaves Chicago for Berlin, just as I left New York for Berlin, AIDS was a very menacing, threatening, unpredictable thing hanging over young life. And he's partly in flight from that. He's certainly in flight from a certain kind of 9-to-5 life or professional decisions here in the States. It's because he's not really an artist and doesn't think of himself as a writer that he's got no sort of thing he's doing. But again, it's very true to what I remember about people in Berlin. Didn't know what they thought they were doing, but they were there doing something, planning something. They all had various kinds of dreams. And so he's one of these guys.
He's living with a relative who he is, would you say, counterpointed with? She has been a concert pianist. Our hero's mother has helped her with questions about weight, with questions about becoming a diva, has given cello, as she's called, her real name is Ruth Ann, the opportunity to lose the weight, to put on the display, and yet when put under spotlights to play for an audience, cello vomits on herself. There's the sense that the role that has been constructed for these people to inhabit is uninhabitable, at least by them.
Yes. Yeah, there's a kind of damage. If it's related to race, I'm not sure. Maybe. In her case, I think I thought of it as probably some reaction to her father being so mad, schizophrenic, and an embarrassment to her. And so presenting herself in public becomes maybe impossible. Maybe it's tied like that in my mind. I sort of wrote it so that I thought, or I hope I had written it, so that things echo, things mirror, things come back twice. If I say the Confessions of Zeno, somewhere else someone will mention a street performer named Zeno, just to have this music of twice.
Yes, it's quite hallucinatory.
Yeah, it's meant
and
to be.
And everything that happens in the book, I think, happens twice.
Yes.
Jed goes home to Chicago not once, but twice.
Yes.
There are, as you say, references. Did you design a plan for this book?
No. It emerged in the telling. It came from a voice. And for my great feeling about Berlin and maybe nostalgia for my youth, I was able to stay in Berlin because I met the theater director, Robert Wilson, and went to work for him. And,
lucky you.
Yes, I was very lucky because if you're sitting in the theater, you make friends and you learn the language and you also have a job. So I had to find a way to make the same possible for Jed, but not with any future attached to it. And so Rosen Montag, the architect he works for, is meant to be some kind of blend of various large personalities who worked in Berlin and got these outrageous commissions to do various things. I don't want to name any names. But
and how can one say Rosen Montag without hearing Susan Sontag?
I know, I worried a little bit about that.
Was she a part of the construction of this character?
Susan?
Mm-hmm.
When she appeared at the bookstore, I knew I was just setting up the last line. I didn't want it to be him saying, home is the place where someone doesn't wish you any pain because he failed to find a home. You know, it had to be this American authority in Berlin who sort of says that to him. And again, because just personally, Susan and I had such wonderful times together there.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Daryl Pinkney about his book, Black Deutschland. We'll continue after this short break.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Daryl Pinkney about his latest book, Black Deutschland, the story of a young black man in 1980s Berlin to either flee his identity or run headlong into it. Now, I think you've made a rather risky book, because at a time when many, what should you call them, race novels are about success and how someone triumphed over a background, these characters are mostly lost, and they compare themselves to what they call competent Negroes. What are competent Negroes?
I'm not sure what that is. He has a brother who does everything right and is an achiever. Maybe that's a competent Negro or a Negro achiever, actually an exceptional person. And in black history, any achievement, any personal achievement stood as possibility or victory for the race itself. But it's very hard to carry this kind of responsibility or rise to it or meet it sometimes. Cello and Jed, rather sort of privileged from that upper middle class Hyde Park world. And so their failure is a bit like white kids. Jed's sensibility is of his time, meaning that it used to be that being gay had nothing to do with camp, you know, in spite of Susan's essay. And it's sort of forgotten or lost now because gay people are much more integrated into American society, or more visible, been there all along. But his is a rather elitist culture, and it's not Eurocentric. It's what was gay at the time, you know, because he meets this black American composer there who sort of embodies that world where only certain people knew about Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, Samuel Barber, Menotti as gay guys, you know, not just as musicians, but in that sort of world. So for him, the culture he looks for in Berlin or is a part of is to him part of this kind of alternative world, you know, sort of where he can be himself.
Although the book is set in Germany in the 80s, the book is a place like Germany in the 80s. Figures keep dropping by. There's a wonderful anecdote about Louis Armstrong. Ella Fitzgerald is here. The book says anyone who can come is in some place available there.
Yeah.
And that was the life of the mind as it was beginning to come to an end in the 1980s.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
That this is a culture that still has its books, although it doesn't know where to put them.
Yeah.
It doesn't want to give them up. Everywhere they go, you're carrying your books with you.
Yeah.
They're getting sludgy.
Yeah.
They're getting mildewed.
And they're not getting replaced.
They're not getting replaced.
That's, you're, you know,
not reading the new books.
Still. Yeah. I mean, the book is meant to be funny, open, but yet at the bottom, it's sort of saying this protagonist made a mistake.
What is Jed's mistake?
Staying in Berlin after the wall went down. You know, he kind of ends up managing a crew of pot dealers in Hasenheide Park because he is not integrated into German society. He doesn't have a job that has benefits with it. He doesn't marry a German. You know, he's just by himself, one of these unexplained older figures in the neighborhood cafe.
Because I was about to ask you whether Berlin still has a thriving expatriate
yes,
community.
Yes, absolutely. the hardest thing about Berlin is letting it belong to other people. So when the sort of transvestite character tells him, oh, you should have been here in Berlin in 1937, and then later on someone is saying, oh, you should have been here in Berlin in 1977. If I'm talking to someone now, I would say, oh, you should have been in Berlin in 1988. I don't know. But now, for instance, Berlin is full of Israeli kids who are getting away from something and going the one place where it's really a story or complicated for them being there. Yes. So certainly Berlin is still that for a different generation.
Do you think it's harder to be an Israeli kid in Berlin than to be a black man, black gay man in Berlin?
This is why those films about blacks and sexual relations in Berlin were made in the 80s in the kind of underground, because black guys went there thinking this is a place where they do like me, where they are interested in me. I mean, he has Isherwood on his mind, but the book Black Deutschland has nothing to do with the Berlin stories,
nothing.
And that's not a model for it. It's a completely different kind of book. He's just obsessed with Isherwood. He and Isherwood have the same taste, and in Isherwood it's not nice, whereas in Jed, who notices? For Isherwood, it's an upper-class guy who likes working-class guys.
Can this be a complex and ambiguous salute to a way of life that has passed?
Oh, completely. So this is certainly a love letter to a dream, to a certain time in life, and to those post-war feelings that the earth could be civilized, all of which, you know, is kind of lost. I mean, in Black Deutschland, you get glimmers of the confrontation with the Muslim presence about to happen because of the, you know, the population in Berlin. They had a lot of refugees and asylum seekers, so it gave you a false sense that the city was rather cosmopolitan. Maybe it wasn't, but the life a foreigner led there was.
I've been talking with Daryl Pinkney, author of Black Deutschland, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you very much, Daryl, for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to have met you.
Me too.
Yeah.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Black Deutschland at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Mark Da Silva is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.